From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, stud horses and stud poker. First, the sex lives and big business of racehorses retired to stud. We talk with Kevin Conley, author of the book Stud, Adventures in Breeding. Conley is an editor at the New Yorker magazine. Then, bluffing, cheating, and gambling. We talk with Andy Bellin, author of Poker Nation. He dropped out of grad school to play semi-pro poker. He's been a regular at several underground poker clubs in New York. And we remember country music great June Carter Cash. She died yesterday at the age of 73. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration commended Saudi officials today for what they said is close cooperation in the investigation of Monday's bombings in Riyadh. The bombings left 34 people dead, including 8 Americans. Attorney General John Ashcroft said he hopes the Saudis are coming to understand that they have a problem with terrorism.
We want to work with the Saudis and are working with the Saudis to curtail terrorism, not only in Saudi Arabia, but around the world. I'm delighted with the indications that the Saudis are taking this matter very seriously.
In Riyadh, NPR's Kate Seeley says an FBI team has visited the bombing sites and is taking part in the investigation.
They are here to assist the Saudis in their investigation. Yesterday, the American ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Robert Jordan, said that he expected the cooperation between the two countries to be positive. He said there is a sincere, good faith effort on both parts to cooperate, to work as partners, and to share information.
NPR's Kate Seeley in Riyadh. The White House says President Bush will continue to press for a bigger tax cut than the one passed last night by the Senate. The Senate version would provide $350 billion in tax cuts over 10 years, including a provision that would temporarily eliminate taxes on corporate dividends. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said the president will urge a bigger tax cut package when the Senate version is reconciled with the $550 billion measure passed by the House. Prosecutors have filed criminal charges against students from a suburban Chicago high school who took part in a violent hazing ritual. Ben Calhoun reports from Chicago Public Radio.
Cook County prosecutors say they're charging 15 students with misdemeanor battery. The charges come from an incident where Glenbrook High School seniors beat junior girls, threw feces and garbage at some, and choked others. The teens face a possible year in jail, probation, and up to a $2,000 fine. Cook County State's Attorney Dick Devine says the investigation is going slowly because some allegedly involved won't cooperate with authorities.
When everybody you talk to says they have a lawyer and don't want to talk to you, there's an issue. And the issue for this community is whether people are going to come forward and are going to cooperate with law enforcement.
Devine says investigators are considering charges for other students. So far, school administrators have suspended 32 teens because of the hazing. For NPR News, I'm Ben Calhoun in Chicago.
President Bush formally began his reelection bid today, filing his notice of intention to run with the Federal Election Commission. Officials said the president plans to appear at his first presidential fundraiser in June. In stocks, the Dow lost 34 points to close at 86.78. The Nasdaq lost 13 to 15.38. This is NPR News. Military officials say another top former member of Saddam Hussein's government has been arrested. The man, Adil Abdallah Mahdi al-Duri, was captured yesterday in a village not far from Saddam's hometown of Tikrit. Mahdi was number 52 on a list of 55 former Iraqi officials who were wanted by the U.S. A Palestinian cabinet member says he hopes veteran negotiator Saeb Erekat can be persuaded to rescind his decision to resign from the Palestinian cabinet. Erekat handed in his resignation in what officials called a dispute with new Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Erekat, one of the best-known Palestinian negotiators since the Madrid talks more than a decade ago, resigned after being excluded from the delegation due to meet Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon Saturday evening. Erekat is considered loyal to Yasser Arafat, who recently fought with Mahmoud Abbas over the powers of the new prime minister. One of Arakat's fellow cabinet ministers, Nabil Shaath, says the resignation doesn't take effect immediately.
This resignation has not been accepted, and we still hope it will be reversed once we go to the cabinet tomorrow in Gaza.
The meeting between Sharon and Abbas is expected to address the roadmap for the peace process in advance of Sharon's visit to Washington next week. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Authorities in South Texas say they've arrested the driver of a tractor-trailer rig that was found to contain 18 suspected illegal immigrants. The discovery was made about 10 miles from Victoria, where a migrant smuggling scheme left 18 people dead on Wednesday after they were crammed into an unventilated trailer. Authorities said today's incident didn't involve any deaths. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Susan B. King, for support of the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. The winner of this year's Kentucky Derby was a horse named Funnyside, a gelding, which is a castrated horse. So Funnyside won't be able to share the destiny of many champion racehorses, the life of a stud. A good stud can earn a fortune. And what a way to earn a living. As our guest Kevin Conley writes, the money is phenomenal, the sex is brisk and multifarious, and the settings are as green and unembarrassed as Eden. Conley is the author of the book Stud, all about the breeding of racehorses, from the intimate acts to the big business. It's now in paperback. Conley is an editor at The New Yorker. Terry talked with him last year. When he was researching his book, Stormcat was the top-paid stud, and he still is.
Stormcat, the top stud in 99 and 2000, was making, at the time I began this story, $300,000 for a date, and it's currently up to $500,000 this year, which means at a conservative estimate of 50 such dates a year, he's making $20 million a year. That's not counting the contracts that he has on the side, the long-term contracts with the farm that he has to honor, and various outside farms who realized early on that this was something worth getting in on.
Who would have suspected that sex could be quite that lucrative? How many offspring has Stormcat sired?
I'm not sure what the count is up to because this is foaling season, but mm-hmm. I think last year it was somewhere around 720. And he's very valuable because of those 720, 93 have become stakes winners. Thoroughbred races are graded, and the top echelon of race is a stakes race. And those stakes race winners are very rare, and he sired 93.
Do you think if you sire that many horses that they'd become less valuable because there's so many of them?
Well, the value that Stormcat can give is not necessarily at the racetrack. This is kind of hard to grasp. You pay $500,000 really for the chance to turn around in another year and a half, 2 years, and sell him at a yearling, sell that foal at a yearling sale. And last year, Stormcat's foals, yearlings, sold for an average of $1.7 million, and that, I believe, was on a $250,000 or $300,000 investment. So people turned right around and made $1 million in change on their $300,000, $250,000 investment. And that's really why he's valuable. Now, people who want to get into the horse racing game know that Stormcat is the horse to go to if you want to get a real runner. So there are rich people lining up to get into the thoroughbred racing game, and that's another reason why it's valuable.
Why is a stud considered to be worth that much? I mean, I'm thinking that the performance of a horse probably has a lot to do with that horse's temperament as well as its genetics. Maybe the temperament is part of the genetics, but like for human beings, we think that the makeup of a human being is part genetic, but part a function of environment and chance. Wouldn't that be true for horses, too?
Absolutely. That's the argument against cloning. If you were to clone five secretariats, who knows how many would make it to the track. One might run into a fence and the other might have lead paint fall down into its feed bowl. And there's, of course, it's just like humans that winning at the races is not necessarily a matter of breeding the fastest horse. For a horse, the race is itself a social event, and they're paying attention to a lot of back and forth nonverbal signals about dominance and submission all the way through the race. Sometimes the race is won before the horses even get in the gate. And so breeding the horse to have that qualities is not just choosing the fastest mare and the fastest filly. You often are breeding for intangibles like temperament and aggressiveness, patience and intelligence, ability to avoid problems.
Does it matter to a horse in terms of its breeding and its ability to race whether it was born through artificial insemination or through an act of actual congress?
Yes, you can't be a thoroughbred unless you've been born by an act of sexual congress. All other breeds use artificial insemination. It's very helpful. It means that you can take a horse in Ohio and impregnate a mare in California or Vancouver. And what this does with thoroughbreds is this prohibition against artificial insemination means that the mares have to travel to where the stallions are. And in this country, the stallions, the highest concentration of stallions, the most valuable studs in the world, are all in about a 60-mile radius centered around Lexington, Kentucky. That's where Stormcat was, is. That's where a point given has retired. I would bet that 90% of the horses in the top 100 are in Kentucky.
I know that you've been to the places where the breeding takes place. Would you describe one of those places for us?
Well, they all look as beautiful as any English boarding school. At the top of the line farms, they have a colonnade of trees, beautiful Irish stone fences, slate roofs, oak barns. When you get to, say, Coolmore, Ashford Stud in Kentucky, even the hay seems to be art directed. There's so much money in the business that they're selling you the dream as well as the barnyard experience.
What happens when it's time for the mare and the stud to perform the act of congress? How are they like introduced? How do they get together?
Well, before the mare and this stallion, the valuable stallion, are introduced, there's a teaser stallion who has to come in and do his job. Now, the teaser stallion is there because the actual stallion is much too valuable to get kicked by a mare who isn't quite in the mood yet. So they bring some horse who hasn't been quite as good at the track. The stallions have these noble names like Stormcat or Dynaformer or Conquistador Cielo or Seattle Slough. And the teaser stallions have gas station-type names, you know, Earl and Honcho and Coop and Skitchy. And they'll bring old Coop in, and he'll try a jump. Often he wears a leather apron and something of the sort to make sure that he doesn't get too intimate with the mare. But when it's clear to everyone in the barn that the mare is not about to kick the prize horse flesh, who's probably waiting in the wings at this point, the poor teaser stallion is hauled off to get frustrated again tomorrow or maybe later in the afternoon, and the stallion steps in. The stallion pretty much believes that everything that walks through the breeding shed door is his, and by this point, he's heard some of the goings-on, and he is ready to go, usually, if he's a professional with a high libido. And he, depending on his personality, different horses are different. Seattle Slough seemed to be very gentlemanly in his address of the mare, cautious to make sure that the teaser stallion had done his job correctly. He seemed to come up along the side and gently nuzzle her down her flanks and then take a tentative jump himself on his own. Of course, all of this is going on in the presence of six or more professionals who choreograph the event for efficiency, speed. There is a man or woman holding the mare's lead shank, somebody holding the stallion's lead shank. There's what's called a tail man who will pull the mare's tail back at the last minute. There is a stallion manager ready to guide the stallion home when he rears. And there are, of course, usually a vet or several other grooms in attendance in case they're needed. Some stallions are a little bit more leisurely about the act, and sometimes somebody will come from behind and kind of give him an extra push if he seems to be a little slow at his job. It's really, in its own way, a little like the New York City Ballet, very highly choreographed. And when it's done well, which it almost always is, it takes about 30 seconds, probably about an eighth of the time it's taken me to describe it.
Does there have to be any chemistry between the mare and the stallion?
Well, it's funny because there are definitely some stallions who have their preferences. The Seattle Slough seem to like gray mares, I was told. And when I went to visit a feral herd, which was a group of about 60 horses who had arranged themselves into different harems, each of the stallions, the harem stallions, seem to have chosen according to his own preference. There was a stallion they called Hershey who seemed to prefer kind of chocolatey brown horses. There was another one who liked the kind of paint variety with dapple colors. And so, yes, they have their preferences, and they have their preferences often, and their moods, but they... The professionals in the breeding shed will make sure the job is done. Sometimes it will take 40 minutes, and generally it's pretty quick.
Does it seem like the mare or the stallion get any pleasure out of the act?
It's hard to know exactly.
I feel like such a voyeur talking about the horses doing this. it's odd to talk about.
It is very odd to talk about it, and when I first went down, I felt strange in actually being there. But everybody there was so comfortable. This is, you have to remember, million-dollar properties being created. This is a business, and mm-hmm. these are people whose job is to make sure that it's done well. And actually, I was more embarrassed about my embarrassment in the end than anything else.
So do the horses get any pleasure out of it?
Certainly the stallions seem to enjoy it. The mares seem to have a drive to reproduce that is quite strong. Most of the time, they could care less about the stallion. Pretty much 11 months of the year and 27 days. But during those 3 days or so of estrus, they couldn't be more come hither in their behavior.
Kevin Conley speaking with Terry Gross. His book Stud is now out in paperback. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back now to Terry's interview with Kevin Conley, the author of the book Stud, Adventures in Breeding. He's an editor at The New Yorker.
How do the owners know when the horse is going to be, when the mare is going to be ovulating?
Well, that's one of the reasons why in the past 30 years or so, this business has become so much more lucrative than it used to be. For much of this century, stallion could only manage about 40 or so dates a year. But with a lot of the increase in the accuracy of pinpointing the ovulation in that veterinarians can do, they've been able to know exactly when the mare is ovulating and hustle her right over to the breeding shed. So they've been able to double, triple, even quadruple in some cases, that 40 a year. Last year's leading stud, Thunder Gulch, I believe, had 216 dates. Live covers, they call it in Kentucky.
And will the mare almost definitely get pregnant?
I think the standard is 60% conception rate.
Do you have to pay if your mare doesn't get pregnant? Do you still have to pay the full
fee? Most of the contracts, and there are definitely a variety of contracts. Most of the contracts are for a guaranteed live foal, which means they will give you another chance until mm-hmm. you get pregnant, and you will pay the stud fee on the delivery of an animal, four legs on the ground.
Right. Meanwhile, let's back up a second. What happens to the teaser stallion who's brought out to arouse the mare? Then the stallion's led away in frustration. Then what?
You know, I have to say that I really identified with the teaser stallions through it. They seem to have a lot of personality. And you know, I was, in my own life, I was more the guy who sat around and made the jokes and then went off to get a drink for somebody. And meanwhile, the moody and attractive man had left with the person I'd been talking with. And so the role of teaser stallions, I always wanted to follow them and find out what they do. They pretty much have a life that's filled with frustration. But when I visited the feral herd, I spoke with the woman who runs that research center, and she was actually a therapist for the dysfunctional stallion and used this feral herd as a kind of laboratory for the psychological health of the stallion. The stallion in the wild is always potent, always fertile, always healthy, and it's in the thoroughbred breeding farms that you find these strange problems. And one of the things that she told me was that as soon as a stallion gains access to the mare, his testosterone level skyrockets. And as soon as he's taken away, within hours, his testosterone level drops. And teaser stallions often spend the most time around the mares. They spend a lot of their day going around the broodmare barns, checking to see if the mares who live there are ready to ovulate, kind of giving a preliminary check. And so, strangely, it's the teaser stallions often who have the highest testosterone level on the farm. The stallions who usually live in seclusion, by themselves, often in a barn, housed at night with the other stallions, but they're kept away from each other. They live like monks on their own because there is a belief that stallions are very aggressive. They are, in fact, very aggressive. And left to their own devices, these stallions would fight to the death.
So the poor teasers get no relief?
They very rarely do. The people who work at the barn often work most with the teaser stallion. In other words, the stallions will come and go, but the teaser is there for mare after mare, so that they feel kind of close to the teasers too. So they will make sure often that he gets a little fulfillment at some point. There are there's a strange thing. Many of the things that humans have a kind of analog in the horse world, and thoroughbred mares are often so nervous that they reject their foal, and the farm has to bring in a nurse mare, kind of like a nanny, to be a wet nurse for the expensive foal. And those nurse mares, contractually, have to be returned to their owner pregnant. And a lot of farms take pity on these teaser stallions, and it's the teasers who do the job of getting the nurse mares pregnant. So there is relief.
Well, here's the question I need to ask. How did all this horse sex affect your libido?
Well, now, I've spoken with a psychiatrist who treats a lot of horsemen down in Lexington, and I've heard that there's a certain jump that they get from being around a particularly prepotent sire, as they say. I can't really admit on national radio to any effect in my own personal life. I do have a four-month-old baby.
So did watching the process of horse breeding affect your interest in horse racing?
Yes. I now pull for the youngins of the sires that I've seen in the breeding shed, definitely. It's very easy to get a kind of rooting participation, just interest in thoroughbred racing because of that.
Well, Kevin Conley, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kevin Conley is the author of the new book, Stud, Adventures in Breeding. It's now in paperback. One of horse racing's biggest races, the Preakness, takes place tomorrow. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and here's the guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, can do. This guy says the horse can do. If he says the horse can do, can do, can do.
I'm picking Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9. But look at Evans happy with it by a half, according to this here is a telegraph.
For Paul Revere out fight, I hear his foot's all right. Of course it all depends if it rained last night.
I know it's Valentine, the morning marks look fine. Besides the jockeys, brother's a friend of mine.
And just a minute, boys, I got the Phoenix noise. It takes his great-grandfather like terrible poise.
I tell you, Paul Revere, now this is no bum steer. It's from a handicap, but that's real sincere.
I go for Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers, and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of On the Nature of Human Romantic Interaction, fictional stories by Carl Jan Yema. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, dropping out of grad school to become a card shark. We talk with poker player Andy Bellin, who hung around Manhattan poker parlors, got hooked, and ended up with a book about his adventures. And we listen back to an interview with the late June Carter Cash. She died yesterday at the age of 73.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Bluffing, betting, gambling, and how to spot a cheat are just some of the subjects Andy Bellin tackles in his book Poker Nation. He started to play the game seriously when he attended graduate school in 1992. He was studying physics and astronomy at Wesleyan University when he started to lose himself at the poker table. He got so carried away with the game that he dropped out of school shortly before he expected to flunk out. After giving up on astronomy, he played semi-pro poker for several years and got a job at the literary magazine The Paris Review, where he was encouraged to write. Poker Nation is his first book. It's now out in paperback. Bellin lives in New York City, where poker is technically illegal, but the law is not enforceable unless a third party is benefiting, such as in games that require a fee to pay. Bellin used to belong to several underground poker clubs, but he says they broke up when Mayor Giuliani started enforcing the law. Terry asked Bellin what he liked about those clubs.
The one thing that I never understood about closing them was that it was safe, it was reliable, there was always a game. You knew that you weren't going to get cheated or robbed or anything like that, and they were great games. They were competitive, yet there were a lot of people there that shouldn't have been there that made it sort of profitable.
No people for you to take advantage of.
I guess so. I mean, I hate to think of it that way, but maybe I'll get back into therapy now, but yes.
Give us a sense of the range of people that would show up at these games.
There, it is the most eclectic collection of people you could ever imagine. You'd walk in at 2 in the morning on a Sunday, and it would be, you know, Park Avenue lawyer next to stripper, next to Albanian prince, next to Brooklyn cabbie. It was just the most bizarre but most entertaining group of people.
To what extent do you see poker as a game of chance, and to what extent do you see it as a game of skill?
Well, in any situation involving dice or a deck of cards, there's always an element of luck. But what you have to remember is the theory of probability, which basically defines all random activity, all random chance. And what that basically states is that the more chances you take, the more hands you play, the more times you roll the dice, the more likely it is that the odds will hold true. So in the short run, when you sit down and you play a hand or any, you know, just for a night, there is a lot of luck involved in the game. You can get terrible cards, or you can get good cards, but which is the worst thing to do, and have somebody get better cards, and you'll lose everything. But if you look at poker as a year-long endeavor or a lifelong endeavor, then you're sort of taking the element of chance out. The theory of probability, the more hands you play, dictates that everybody will get the same cards eventually in all the same situations, and the better players will make more money and lose less money, and therefore it's a lot less chance involved.
Where did you learn how to play, and who did you learn from?
Well, God, I'm going to give my family a bad name. My mother taught me when I was very young, and we used to go up to, my grandmother had this sort of haunted house way off in the woods of the Adirondacks, and my mother used to take my brother and I up there, and this was like, you know, early 70s, so there was no TV, no internet, no cable, almost no telephone. So, you know, as two city kids out in the woods, I would do, terrified of everything, I would just try and keep my family up as long as possible, just doing anything. And my mother taught us how to play poker, and I think my first game was it involved mini marshmallows as chips, and we, you know, my brother and I would just play through till the morning when we could sleep then.
So was your mother your poker mentor, or did you have a mentor more from the poker world when you got a little older?
Forgive me, Mom. No, she was not my poker mentor. But when I got into graduate school, I had a math professor who was just an absolute statistics freak. I mean, he just loved everything, would quote these bizarre death statistics about, child mortality in Guatemala or something, and really just, that's the kind of thing that made him happy. And the one thing that he was obsessed with more than anything was poker. And one day he pulled me aside and said, "Do you play?" And I kind of chuckled and said yes, and we sort of ran off like towards the Foxwoods Casino to go play.
And so he was interested in probability and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it was, I mean, whether he would have admitted this or not, he loved the game for the same reasons that I do, the competition and the thrill, and there's sort of something sexy about it. But, I mean, the way he rationalized it to himself was that it's this perfect statistical model. You can just watch the law of averages at work anytime you sit down at a poker table. So that was actually, it's the best way to learn is to start with the math, to start figuring out what the right thing to do is and what's the wrong thing to do. And then you start learning the sort of subtleties along the way, but it was a great poker education.
If you're going to work with laws of probability when you're playing poker, you need to have a good memory and remember what cards have shown up on the table and what hands other people are likely to have, what cards are likely to show up in the future. Did you already have a good memory, or did you learn tricks to train your memory to remember what it is you need to know when you're playing the game?
I think I had an average memory, and I had operated under the assumption that memory was a birthright. You either had a great memory or you didn't. And what I found out along the way was that there were certain tricks, their mnemonics, their ways to organize things by grouping them that improve your ability to retain information. And I don't have a great memory now, but, you know, it certainly helps to try and figure out what works best for your mind, whether it's, you know, you see a series of cards laid on a table, you know, do you try and make up a story? Do you try and spell something out with their first letters? Do you group them, by using patterns or something? And it's an amazing way to help your memory.
What are the things you most want to remember when you're playing?
In a game like Seven Card Stud, where there are a lot of cards exposed, it really helps to, you know, if you've got a pair of threes and you've seen one three in somebody else's hand, obviously that's going to change the way you play the game. You've just cut your odds of making three of a kind in half. So memorizing the cards that have been played is very important. But being able to, particularly because most of the poker that's played in America is played around, you know, in garages and around bar rooms and things like that, you're going to play with the same guys over and over again. So you have to keep in mind the way they play, the things they do, their tendencies. And in that way, it makes them a lot more predictable. And you can, 90% of the time, you can base your actions on more evidence. So that's really going to help you in the long run.
What kind of tendencies do you spot?
You're playing five card draw and somebody draws one card. The classic question is, does he have a four card straight or flush where he's drawing to a big hand, or does he have two pair and he's already got a decent starting hand? There's almost no real way to tell, except there are a lot of people that my friend John is a good example. He's a guy who, when he would have a straight or a flush draw and he needed a fifth card to make a hand, he would never bet it. He would always just call whatever was bet. He would never initiate a bet. But when he had two pair, he would always start the betting. So as soon as I figured that out, I've been playing with him for 10 years now, I when he draws one card, I know what he is doing.
This is not something you would call to his attention, right? You wouldn't say, I've noticed that you have this habit.
I think I just did call to his attention, is he right? Which is so
he
bad.
He might not be listening. But I mean, really, you obviously don't want somebody to be conscious of the things that they're doing that betray them.
Oh, of course not. I mean, you create your private little books on people and you keep them your whole life. I mean, I waited, like I said, I started playing with my brother when I was seven. So, you know, for 25 years almost, and I never told him that he has a great tendency to tell me what his cards are without him knowing it until I wrote the book, and I let him find out by reading the book. So,
his reaction?
He didn't believe it, and then I pointed it out actually last night at a card game. But he has, you know, my brother's an incredibly sturdy sort of, I mean, he's got these huge hands, and he's like this very macho guy. And he just, when he bluffs or when he does something out of the ordinary, he's absolutely steady as a rock. But when he's got the best hand and he's trapped somebody, he gets so excited that his hands shake. Which is completely a dead giveaway. So for years I've known what he's had in his hands.
So do you fold when you see his hand shaking?
Immediately, without a thought, in a second. I can't get the cards out of my hands fast enough.
Andy Bellin speaking with Terry Gross. His book, Poker Nation, is available in paperback. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Andy Bellin, author of the book Poker Nation.
Now, how do you decide if someone else is bluffing? What are some of the things you look for?
Well, people do the weirdest things. We all get drilled into us at an early age that lying is a bad thing to do, and all of the deception we intend to bestow upon people at a poker table it comes into conflict with that. So people have the strangest reactions. People cover their mouths when they bluff. Some people look away. Some people change the tone of their voice. Some people bet way more aggressively physically. They throw the chips in the pot when they're bluffing. Some people do it very sheepishly, like they're embarrassed to be doing this. It all depends on the person, but figuring out a tell like that is really, it's such a huge advantage. When I was in graduate school, I used to play in a game, and apparently, they didn't tell me this until after I left school. Note I said left and not graduated, but after I left school, I was notified that I had a tell where when I would be bluffing or be making a very reluctant call, if it was a $10 bet, I would be doing it with, I would make the wager with small denominations. I would use 10 $1 chips or 20 50-cent chips to get rid of my small chips. And when I was when I had a very good hand, when I was confident in it, I would use a big chip. I would throw in a $10 chip. And it's an amazing tell.
Once you realize you have a tell, is it difficult to get rid of, just as it's difficult to break nearly every habit?
I think it is, but you sort of do it proactively in the sense that you don't recognize the tell and then compensate for it. What you try and do is, whether you're bluffing or whether you're making a reluctant call or whether you've got an amazing hand, you try and go through the process of betting in the exact same way. You do it almost as mechanically as possible. Grab the chips in the same way. You throw them in the pot the same way. You look at your cards in the same way. You bet using the same inflection. And if you can do that, You're better off trying to avoid it proactively rather than reacting to it.
Have you played cards with people who you were sure, or at least pretty confident, were cheating?
I tell everybody that if you've played more than five hands of poker in your life, you've probably been cheated at one point or another, which is not to say that every game you're in is crooked, but if anybody has ever looked at, the bottom card on a deck, they've cheated in a sense. They've taken advantage of some inside information and they've used it without stopping the game and saying redeal the cards. So cheating can be in very subtle and almost meaningless ways. Knowing one card in a deck is an advantage, but not a huge advantage. Or you can get you can have people try and steal the shoes off your feet. And I have been. I was in a poker game in a casino a long time ago where I found that when I didn't even realize that I was playing with what they call a partnered team, where two people sort of signal each other what their cards are, and they try and trap you in between them, where you've got a decent hand, one's got a great hand, one's got a terrible hand, and they just keep raising because they know they're going to split the proceeds in the end. So there is cheating. It's just the problem is that you have to become a very good card cheat yourself to be able to spot it. You have to learn what
like. Why do you have to be a cheat to spot it?
Well, you have to be able to manipulate the deck yourself to know what it looks like when somebody else is doing it. You have to know what it sounds like when somebody is peeking at a card or dealing the second or third card off the deck and not the top one. To be able to spot it. And the only way to become familiar with it is to do it yourself.
In your book, Poker Nation, you write, losing begets losing. Can you talk about that losing spiral that you can fall into?
Yeah, it's you find yourself in the throes of it, and you think, I can't believe I got myself into this again. But you say to yourself, I just lost money, so I have to play more poker to win. And then you play more poker to win your money back, but you've actually lost, so now you have to play even more poker. Also, the mathematics logically conspire against losing, in the sense that if you start out with $500 and you lose 50% of your money, you've got $250. Now you've got to make 100% of your money to get even. So it seems like the further you go, the more difficult it is to crawl out of the hole. And also, when you lose, you start getting frustrated. And when you get frustrated, you start playing irresponsibly. And then when you start playing irresponsibly, you start losing more. And then it becomes this vicious cycle that's terrible and wildly unprofitable and makes for a miserable evening. That's why often the best thing you can do after losing a big hand is just pick up your chips and go home and come back and fight another day.
Are you capable of doing that?
Sometimes, I think. I used to pride myself on the expression for when a player starts losing his mind at a poker table and playing irresponsibly is that he's tilting. And I used to pride myself on never tilting, but the fact was, I guess I used to tilt in my own way. Like one of the most important decisions you have to make at a poker table is if you've lost your money, do you buy back in? And the reason it's so important is you have to figure out why you've lost your money. Were you just getting bad cards and buying back in is going to further your attempts to get even because you're a favorite at that table? Or are you just completely outclassed and just go home and, you know, watch a movie and then come back and hope those guys are gone in the morning? But I was never a great judge of that. So in a sense, I would lose and then I would have that sort of tilty feeling to me, and I'd think, you know what, I got to get back in this game. I'm a favorite at this table, and a lot of the times I wasn't. So I think that was my greatest shortcoming as a player.
Do you believe in beginner's luck?
Absolutely. My girlfriend, the first time she played, just went on a tear. She just couldn't miss. Same is true at a horse racing track. First time I taught her how to throw dice at a crap table, she threw the dice across the table, hit a man in the head, and they fell in the well and turned out an 11, and we won. So, yes, very much so. It's a very important part of the game.
Well, Andy Bellin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. That was great fun.
Andy Bellin is the author of Poker Nation. Coming up, we remember June Carter Cash. This is Fresh Air. June Carter Cash, singer, songwriter, actress, member of one of country music's leading families, and the wife of Johnny Cash, died yesterday from complications of heart surgery. She was 73. Cash was born into the Carter family, who pioneered the use of vocals in country music. Her mother was Maybelle Carter. With the Carter family, she toured, recorded, and was a regular at the Grand Ole Opry. Later, she toured with a young singer named Elvis Presley, and in the 60s, she hooked up with Johnny Cash. Over their 35-year marriage, they performed and collaborated together. Cash often credited her with saving his life when he was struggling to overcome drug addiction. Let's listen to June and Johnny Cash singing their 1967 Grammy Award-winning duet, Jackson.
We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. I'm going to Jackson, I'm gonna mess around. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson. Look out, Jackson Town.
We'll go on down to Jackson. Go ahead and wreck your hell. Go play your hand, you big tough man. Make a big fool of yourself. Yeah, go to Jackson. Go comb your hair.
Honey, I'm gonna snowball Jackson.
See if I can.
When Terry spoke with June Carter Cash in 1987, she asked her about the beginning of her career.
I was about 10 years old. About 10, I think. And I really didn't know if I was going to be able to perform or not. I had two sisters who could perform, and when you're standing there and you're used to just running and catching light bugs and June bugs and riding the motorcycle behind your daddy and being a tomboy, you don't know if you can sing or not.
Did you want to perform?
Oh, I hadn't even thought about it. I didn't think I could. But then mother said, you know, you're going to sing, or at least I guess you are, and you're also going to learn to play that auto harp and that mandolin and that guitar and whatever. So within about a week's time, I learned to sing. I had to. But believe me, Terry, I was up and down that scale because I really didn't know where I was going to begin with.
Sounds like you didn't have a lot of confidence in your singing.
I really didn't, but I had a lot of guts. I really didn't mind trying anything, and I think that's one reason in the beginning that I used to do comedy in the beginning. I just did it because I didn't think I could sing as good as my sisters.
What were the best shows, your favorite shows to do?
Well, I've had a lot of different shows in my life. The Days with the Carter Family, that was a wonderful kind of thing. I can remember doing shows from the days in the old coal fields where there was no electricity at all, and they put the lamps on the front of the stage. I went from that to having our first public address system, doing the little concerts around in schoolhouses and then in larger auditoriums when the Carter Family was around.
When you were young, were you aware of how important your mother was in country music?
I really had no idea. I honest to goodness thought everybody alive had a sweet little blue-eyed mother that picked the wildwood flower on the guitar. But Terry, the one thing that reminded me when my mother did pass away was the television cameras that came from all of the major networks, and then I began to know. And, of course, if there's the times that you ever read history books in country music, she had a strong influence on our music. And, of course, my Uncle A.P. Carter and the songs of the Carter Family. That's kind of a basis for our country music today.
June Carter Cash. As a young woman, she left the world she was so closely associated with and moved to California and New York. She married country music performer Carl Smith and had two daughters, Carlene and Rosie. But when the culture shock of big city life became too much for her, she moved back to Nashville and the Grand Ole Opry. That's when Johnny Cash came into her life.
When you realized that you were both in love, were you ever afraid to marry him because of his chemical dependency?
Oh, of course, of course. I only decided 6 months before we were married. I made my mind up, okay, if you feel that you can stay straight, I will marry you. If that's what you really think that you can do. And he stayed straight for 6 months. But I handed in my resignation to the Grand Ole Opry, and I thought, if you die, I will stand near you while you die. If you live, I will live with you, and I will be with you. I will help you whatever you do. But it was a total commitment that I made at that point. And he never let me down.
In your new book, you've written about women friends and women in your family who were abused by their husbands or who had to put up with drug and alcohol problems that their husbands had. How much power do you think a loving wife has to change her husband if he has a problem either with violence or with drugs or alcohol?
Well, you have much more power if you're a praying woman than you could believe. I prayed continually, and I lifted up all my problems to God. If you have a person who is a chemically dependent person in your family, child or husband, whatever the situation would be, If you pray hard believing that God can help you and you just lift that up, I am living proof that it can work.
You wrote the song Ring of Fire, which Johnny Cash recorded, had a big hit with it. Did you write that song with him in mind?
Yes, I did. You know, he didn't even know, but I think I'd come to grips with the fact that I was in love with this man. He was still at that time with his wife. I was still married at the time. I think that's what the song was about, because, I mean, I couldn't tell anybody. How could I tell anybody? Because it was like a ring of fire.
When you gave the song to Johnny Cash to record, did he know that it was about him?
I don't know. My sister recorded it first, Anita, and it was more like the Carter family might have done it, because we were primarily more folk music. And so then Anita and Helen and Mother and I sung it with John, and we put the trumpets on it, and it became a big, big song. It's been recorded over 100 times.
June Carter Cash, recorded in 1987. She died yesterday at the age of 73. Here's June's version of Ring of Fire from her 1999 solo album, Press On.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. The show was produced today by Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Seuss Boland directed. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
The taste of love is sweet when the hearts like ours beat. I fell for you like a child. Fire went wild. I fell into a burning ring of fire. Went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374. Or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback by Robert Caro, Master of the Senate, The Years of Lyndon Johnson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, visiting Uncle Andy in New York City, we meet James Warhola. He's written a children's book about Andy Warhol. Also, Academy Award winner Chris Cooper. He played an orchid thief in the film Adaptation. Join us for the next Fresh Air.